Hi, this is Dave Rowntree, author of Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting, lecturer, author, and paranormal researcher. And when you're not busy in the field, do what I do and listen to the Mallard Report with Jim Mallard.
The opinions expressed in the Mallard Report are those of the hosts and participants and are not intended to and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of any simulcasting radio network or sponsor. All listeners are advised to make their own decisions.
It's the Mallard Report. Yeah, the Mallard Report. The paranormal talk radio show with Jim Mallard as your host. See what lies beneath any paranormal activity. Go inside a world that others don't want to see. It's the Mallard Report. Yeah, the Mallard Report.
That it is. I want to welcome everybody to the Mallard Report here tonight. My guest, Christopher Mahoney, right? I didn't even ask you that. That's normally the question I ask people. How do they pronounce their last name?
It's Maloney with an L.
Maloney. Oh.
Yeah.
You're going to be correcting me on that again later since I got that wrong in my head.
That's fine.
So how are you doing tonight, Chris?
Fine. You?
Oh, I can't complain too bad, I guess. Nobody would listen to the show if I did, I get the feeling. But, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you're on tonight to talk about Crypto Trip, which is a documentary you've made. How long did it take you to make?
It was just under a year. I started sending out letters and emails and making phone calls in the summer and fall of 2011. And then I finished up the editing in August of 2012. So it's just under a year.
So what was the what made you even want to start filming? I mean, there has to be a backstory that made you want to approach this.
Yeah, well, cryptozoology has been an interest of mine since I was a kid, and it's just a natural thing for me when something's interesting to me to start thinking about it in film form, since that's what I do. But it happened now because I think that the interest in cryptozoology, especially here in the United States, is just at a fever pitch right now. There are so many groups of amateur cryptozoologists and shows about cryptozoology and books and radio programs everywhere. And I wanted to just kind of get a portrait of that, capture the moment that we have right now of cryptozoology and what attracts people to it and what it says about who we are at this point. So it was like a combination of my own interest and then seeing that it's certainly an interest of a lot of other people, and I just wanted to explore that.
So have you had an experience with one? Seeing one?
No,
I
haven't. I haven't. That's something that I think I was able to come into it as an outsider, and I think that helps make me more objective because I have not had that personal experience. So everything that I hear about is just something that I can report on, but I never had like a conversion experience myself. No.
That's a good way to phrase it too, by the way. Conversion experience that you hear too often, that's what it starts to sound like. But I think that's how it happens to some people. So anyways, I guess digress into the religion factor of this all, because that'd probably take us somewhere we'd end up in trouble.
Well, yeah, I think conversion's a good way to look at it, because almost everybody I think everybody sees their lives change in some way after they see something that they can't explain. And for some people, it's a huge change, a total about faith and how they live their lives. And for other people, it's even if it's a small change, it's still a change. So I think conversion works just fine.
Right. So coming at it from a I heard, like I told you in an email, the one morning that I'm up to listen to Coast to Coast, I turn it on, which I'm not a big fan of their show for a number of reasons, but we'll just leave it at that.
I'd like to know, actually.
Well, I just prefer the way I do things, which is I just want to listen to my guests and not have the commercials and all, you know. Just
right.
I have ADD, so if there's a commercial, hey, let's listen to something, you know, that button's going.
Yeah.
Especially,
The commercial time for that program is, unfortunately, it's just enormous.
Yeah.
The breaks that they take are, it's being crowded by commercial time now, and it didn't used to be like that. It didn't used to be as bad as it is now.
So are you an Art Bell fan, then? Is that what I'm gathering?
No, I'm a fan of the show. I just think I often listen to it after it's been broadcast when some kind soul has cut out all the commercials. So you get kind of spoiled listening to it like that, and then when you listen to it live, there's so much waiting around.
Yeah. Well, I was my favorite joke is that you were able to get on their show first before you were able to get on mine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that speaks great things about how exclusive my show is. Of course, they do it six, seven days a week, and I do it one day a week, but we're not going to tell anybody about that. We're just going to say how exclusive my guest list is.
Right.
Little plug there for myself. I'm just kidding. But no, I tuned it in, and I heard one segment with you and Robin Swoop.
Yeah.
And I've actually met Robin once or twice, and he's right up the road from me. I'm from Franklin. He's from Erie, so we're probably an hour and a half apart, something like that.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
So of all the times to hear, you know, that was kind of weird to hear that story. But so what other – I guess we probably should start with his story, I guess, since I just teased it all up. What he told you about – what did he tell you about?
Well, he's an interesting case because he is somebody who's had lots of experiences with lots of different things. So he's seen – UFOs, and he's had encounters with ghosts and evil spirits. He performs exorcisms. It's part of his professional work that he does. Is he performs exorcisms and counsels people who have had experiences with evil spirits. So he's got a lot of experience in the paranormal, but then he's also seen several cryptids. There's a story of a cryptid in the water that he saw when he was doing missionary work in Africa. And then what he spoke to me on film about was a thunderbird sighting, actually in Erie. He was working at a cemetery doing maintenance and grounds work, that sort of thing. And he was by himself mowing the last several acres of the cemetery, and this enormous thunderbird flew out of the woods, and, you know, so much so that he was able to get a clear look at it. And so that was the story that he shared with me in the film, and we did the interview, and then we also went to the spot where it happened so that we could see, and that's on the film too, you get to see actually where it was so that you can get some perspective. But and then a few years later, he ended up, I think 10 years later, he saw it again in the same area. So the Thunderbird, it sounds like there's a Thunderbird, maybe a Thunderbird population that lives in that area, and he's seen them more than once.
Which just blows my mind, of course. It doesn't really, but it does on the other, you know what I'm saying? If you're going to hide, hide up there, I guess, because fewer eyes and fewer, you know, great source of water and this, that, and the other. But so where else did you sneak off to and talk to people about their story at?
You mean what other cryptids were?
Yeah, what other cryptids were in the film?
Well, Bigfoot features pretty prominently. That's kind of how the end of the movie happens to kind of explore Bigfoot, especially in the Pacific Northwest. We went there and just got a feel of what kind of impact Bigfoot has on the culture there, and talked to some eyewitnesses. And we also covered the Mothman and Skunk Ape, Thunderbird, like I mentioned, a living dinosaur. And then there's a story of an unidentified canine creature that was shot back in the 1800s and actually taxidermied. So we got to put the body on film. It's in the film. It's in a little, tiny little museum out in Montana. But, so altogether, I guess it's about six or seven different cryptids.
And my guest tonight is Christopher Maloney, right?
That's right.
Hey, I did it. Changed my mind. I'll probably mess it up again later, but you know how that goes. Of CryptoTrip, I had it. Where'd it go? CryptoTrip.com. There. I did that right, too. That was almost special. And you can find that on Facebook. And are you on Twitter also?
Yeah. My Twitter handle is Maloney's Movies.
So that means there's more than one of these being made then, huh?
More than one.
Movie. What other types of movies do you make?
Well, a few years ago I did a documentary called The Death of Andy Kaufman. And that's available. People can find that where DVDs are sold.
Andy Kaufman, the comedian?
That's right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it explores the possibility that he faked his death.
No. Is he hanging off Elvis then? No.
Is he what?
Is he hanging off Elvis?
I don't know.
He didn't find any footage of that. So, faked his own. No, we can't leave that there. Do you think he did then?
I think an argument can be made that that there was an attempt to fake his death. Yeah, but the conclusions. I mean, you'll have to see the movie to figure it out.
Of course, that's okay though. So okay, so that you've done that. That these are the two, right? I'm not missing anything.
No, there's some other ones that have like smaller, more limited releases. There's a nonfiction documentary I did about the American Shakers, also, like especially in the Massachusetts area that people can look up.
Okay, what's the title of that?
It's called Come Thou Fount: Thoughts on the Shakers. People can find it on Amazon.
Get that out there in case somebody wanted to look it up. So, besides, you were just at the Cryptid Internet. I just had that open too. The International Cryptid Museum in Michigan, right?
No, it's in Maine.
Maine.
Yeah.
M-I-M-A. I was close.
It's in me, actually.
Oh, well, geez, oh, Pete. So, you were up there screening the film. Tell me how that went.
It went really well. It was 2 days ago, Sunday, and it was the first screening in New England, so it was the New England premiere. And it was at Lauren Coleman's Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine. And it was a very good event. It sold out, actually. So there was the screening, and then people were able to come and just visit the museum, hang around in the museum. And then after that, I got to, field some questions from the audience and meet everybody. And so it was a nice event. It was really kind of a unique experience because instead of being in a theater, you were in a museum surrounded by, a life-size Bigfoot statue and a huge pterodactyl hanging on the wall and all sorts of interesting things.
So did it make you want to film part two?
Someone asked about that while I was there. Actually, I did film in the museum. I interviewed Lauren Coleman for the film. So it was kind of interesting because you were, for the event, you're sitting in the museum watching footage of the museum. So it was kind of a strange full circle moment.
That would be. Did you see people looking around to see if anything was different, or were they just intrigued in the movie, or?
They had it projected in a way that it was kind of up high on the wall, so it felt like you were at a drive-in, sort of. And so I was kind of, I didn't really watch it, but I was kind of standing on the outskirts watching people watch it, and everybody seemed very engaged. And actually, when I mentioned the Cryptozoology Museum, it got some applause.
Well, I would hope so.
Yeah.
So, back to... Well, okay. I've got two questions, and I want to ask them both at the same time, and that's not going to work, obviously. I could just make this big run-on question, and you'd hate me forever, but... How long did it take you to get to the final cut? How many times did you think you've seen the pieces of the movie? Because I know it'd probably drive you nuts trying to watch it again.
What exactly do you mean?
Well, you filmed the segments, and then you probably edited them, and then you probably, you got your segments, and then you probably wanted to put them together. How many times did, like, the segment about the museum, how many times did you end up watching that, trying to get it right, and then get it right in the broad picture of the movie?
Oh, I don't know. You have to have a high tolerance. When you edit, you have to have a high tolerance for repetition because you watch the same things over and over and over again. But, no matter how many times you see a certain segment, when you combine it with other segments, it takes on a life of its own. So, I could watch every segment of the film by itself and then watch the whole film together, and it would be a completely different experience, the way that they connect to each other.
I guess that's why you make movies and I host a radio show, because I can't stand to go back and listen to my... Well, that's why I do it live and just be done with it. I've tried listening to my own shows, and it drives me nuts. I tried to piece one out once, and I just went, nope, that's not for me. They just have to deal with it. Nope. That's horrible to say. So the other question was, it was just you that filmed this, or did you have a crew?
I don't have a permanent crew. It kind of worked out that, I would recruit different people to help with different parts of it. So there were certain friends and family who came on the trips with me and helped with the interviews and things like that. But as far as, like, editing and the interviews and that sort of thing, it's... Most of it fell on me to do it.
I just, like I said, better you than me, because I'd be insane. Oh.
Yeah.
So, besides promoting the crypto trip, what is currently, are you filming anything else, or?
Well, I have other, there are always projects in development, I think, but. For CryptoTrip, I want to make sure I give it as much attention as it needs to reach as many people as possible before I move on. So right now I'm trying to find a distributor to pick it up and just kind of, take it to where the most people can see it.
So that's becoming a process of probably a lot of no answers or no's, huh?
That's kind of the nature of it.
As I say, it only takes one, though, to turn the thing around.
So. Yeah, without a studio backing it, you have to kind of rely on word of mouth, which is why it's so important to take it to as many screenings as I can, because all the people there will hopefully, you know, they'll talk about it to their friends, and then their friends will talk about it to their friends. And, the filmmaking is such now that you can get buzz around a small, cheap thing that someone has made, because the whole playing ground has been leveled because of digital video and personal documentaries, and now anybody can be a filmmaker, whether you're successful or not. Anybody can be a filmmaker, so there's more competition than ever, and you just have to hope that what you've done connects with enough people that it becomes a, you know, a viable piece of art.
Yeah, it's just like, well, the radio thing and books and just anything anymore. So it's so digital. So, but it probably makes, well, I know it makes it easier to edit for you, of course. Makes it easier to film. Well, probably. I don't know. It's not my expertise, but. So, besides getting it found, what's the biggest challenge now? I mean, that's not even a good question, because I know it's all the work that goes into that, but.
Well, the challenge now is to get a distributor, and then that's why I'm submitting it to film festivals and taking it to screenings, because we just need somebody to get it and decide what we're going to put it on TV, or we're going to put it on a DVD or in theaters. You know, I want to see that everything I worked on to get it finished will be, you know, put into the hands of everybody who wants to experience it. And it's too much for one person to do. So now's the time where I try to, you know, make it connect with a distributor so that it can be available to everybody.
So if anybody's out there listening, I'll get you in touch with Chris, and we'll pass it along. Can people go watch it now if they want to? Is there anywhere for them to buy a DVD or see it?
DVDs can be purchased on my website, cryptotrip.com, but it's not available to see for free.
There it is. Of course, you know, I was looking at your website all day, and well, not all day, but I didn't see buy DVD. I was reading the about and, you know, all this other stuff, and one trick pony there, I guess. So that's okay. It's a clean site, by the way. If anybody hasn't went and checked it out, I'd go do it. Just throwing my 2 cents into that, because being a guy host does design my own sites. That's got to be another thing. Trying to do the social media, the sending the emails, how much time do you drop into that? Just trying to get to festivals and
trying to get the movie into festivals.
Just trying to festivals. We'll just go with that.
Well, it's interesting how you have to, when you're making a film, you have to change gears so many times and change your thought process so many times, because when you start out doing the research and gathering interviews, it's a very kind of studious thing to do, academic almost thing that you do, because it's a lot of just research, reading, writing, communicating with people, and there's nothing schematic about it at all. And then you move into the production part, where you're using cameras and mics and things like that, and you've totally switched into a different mindset. And then when it's all finished, you get into the, it almost feels like hustling. You're just trying to, you've done all the hard work, and now you need to get it out there. So it's three completely different stages that are all with the common goal of making a film. So at this stage now, I'm a filmmaker, but I'm doing the role of like an agent or a manager, because I'm trying to get the product out there. And so you just have to be willing to do whatever it takes, even if it takes you outside of your comfort level, to do whatever it takes to get the work to connect with people.
Yeah, it's got to be a trick going from one person to the next and then totally switching gears and trying to sell, you know. It's all about two phases of it's trying to sell something, trying to sell people on making the movie, and then later trying to sell them once you've made the movie. So.
Yeah, basically. I hate to think of it like that, but there is a salesmanship quality to it. But I remember reading something that one of my favorite filmmakers said. He said, you know, most of his time is spent raising money for his movies, but if the material is strong enough, the money has a way of just showing up. And so that's what I try to remember.
That'd be good news, wouldn't it, if somebody just took off and ran with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, out of all the places and stories and things you heard over the course of putting this together, I'm sure that you've heard stuff that didn't make the final cut and all this stuff.
Yeah.
What's the one story that will always? The one story that made you, like, here we go, made you laugh the most, that you just knew was somebody trying to pull one over on you?
Well, most of the stories that I, certainly all the stories that are in the film were very, almost kind of traumatic experiences, but there was one that I decided not to pursue. There are stories of a lake monster in North Carolina, and that was something I'd been hearing about, but I the reason I wanted to pursue it and cover it was because I hadn't seen it covered on any shows or in any books, really. So I thought, you know, we could possibly be the first ones to really look at it in depth. So I talked to the person, the contact person in North Carolina, who was kind of handling the stories and reporting eyewitness encounters and things like that. I talked to him, for a while, and he eventually admitted that the whole story was something he had come up with to try and get more tourism in the area. So, and that was exactly the opposite of what I was looking for. So that was something. Obviously, I decided not to go along with.
That's kind of funny that you said that, because a few minutes before the show, I fired a question out on my social media, what's Bigfoot or Loch Ness Monster, and somebody tweeted back to me, Windy City Paranormals tweeted back to me, messy, because the government knows but won't say it. They want to keep tourists to that area. It's the number two tourist area in the U.K.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, I missed part of it. Nessie is a giant eel. See, if I could read, this would be much better. So, now to put you on the spot. Of all the ones that you've heard about, like Loch Ness Monster and all the different ones, the Yeti overseas, is there one that you would have liked to go pursue, but obviously due to budget you couldn't?
I would love to investigate the Loch Ness Monster sometime. That was really the first cryptid I knew about back when I was a kid. I've always thought it would be interesting to just go to Inverness and in Scotland and just pull out a lawn chair and sit by the water for a long time in hopes of seeing something. But I actually, I've heard that it's probably a type of seal that is larger than the common seal that we are familiar with, and that's what people are seeing. But, I mean, it's a good thing for communities when when a cryptid is sighted, because it can suddenly, it can put your town on the map. Whereas there was not much interest before. I know that happened with Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and the Mothman. The Mothman sightings were back in the 60s, and Point Pleasant was just a little town that, most people are not familiar with, but now because of the sightings, everybody knows Point Pleasant. Everybody's heard of Point Pleasant, West Virginia. And every year they have, this is in the film, every year they have a Mothman Festival. I think they just finished their 11th annual one. And up until the time they started having the festival, the town was kind of economically depressed. Their downtown area was really suffering. And someone had the idea of, why don't we capitalize on the Mothman thing and start our own museum and just try and get people in here. And it worked, because when we went there for the festival, it was huge. It was a huge event. And everybody coming in, they need a place to eat, so they go to a restaurant in town. They need a place to stay, so they go to a nearby hotel. And it's really kind of revitalized the area. And I actually, just a few weeks ago, I went through my old hometown. I had to go through there for something. And it looked so much worse than when I was growing up there. A lot of the buildings are boarded up. The businesses are closing. And I thought, if this place would benefit from some strange creature sighting or a UFO landing or something, because something needs to help this place really get its legs back. And that's funny, because the cryptid sightings have a habit of doing that for wherever they're seen. Suddenly people who didn't know about the place before want to go there and check it out for themselves.
Interesting. I mean, I guess I had that in the back of my mind. I guess I never really crossed that bridge, so.
Yeah, if your town is suffering or economically depressed, you should hope and pray for a Bigfoot sighting.
See, Obama, that's what we need, more Bigfoot sightings. Oh. And there's your political
part
of the show.
Yeah.
I've been pushing the envelope. I almost talked about religion, and now I talked about politics. So let's talk about money. Oh, I'm just kidding. No. I think we probably dabbled on that, too.
Fine. Yeah, I'm up for it.
Well, here, hold on. It's the Mallard Report. I probably should tell people that once or twice an hour. My guest tonight is Christopher Maloney. Crypto Trip, the documentary. I keep calling it a movie, but it's actually a documentary, right?
Well, it's both. A documentary is a type of movie.
I know, but I don't want to be giving people the wrong idea.
Yeah. Okay. You can say a documentary film.
Okay, there
your
we
basis.
Go. See, I told you just to go ahead and jump on me if I said something wrong. It's okay.
No, you're fine.
I promise not to bite back too hard. I've got the duck thing going on. It's okay. You know. Somebody's going to kill me for that later, I'm sure, but that's okay. No, but I just mentioned money, but, boy, it has to eat a lot of it to even try to, before I even start out the door, like cameras and editing software and, I mean, it's just not a, it can't be a, I don't want to say hobby, but, because it'd be an expensive hobby, I guess.
It's not a cheap thing to do with your life, certainly. Even most Hollywood movies do not make a profit. That's just kind of how the system works. Movies are so expensive to make. Even mine is what you call a micro-budget movie. There's no studio backing, so it's an independent film, but it still requires money to get it made. And the money that it required was extremely small. And so with that, it just never, the money required for everything, for the traveling to accomplish the interviews, not to mention the equipment, and then afterward, it always costs money to enter your film in film festivals. So it's a very, very expensive, and if you're on the other end, lucrative business to be in.
You mentioned how Hollywood movies don't make money, so how do they keep perpetuating making movies then?
It's kind of strange how it works. Like, a movie will cost an enormous amount to make, and it'll come out, and most of them don't make the money back in the theaters. But eventually, through DVD sales and rentals and on-demand streaming and things like that, eventually, years down the line, it'll finally break even. It's very strange how it works, but as long as the studio keeps generating money for themselves, they can afford to keep producing more movies, and they really don't make their money back on a project-by-project basis until years and years and years down the line, if at all.
Sounds flawed to me, I guess. I'd rather make
it. Yeah, it's really complicated the way it works.
I mean, I guess that you had to have a big capital investment to start doing something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, because obviously I couldn't go out and start doing that because I'd be broke because I'd make two movie or a 30-second commercial and be broke because I didn't make my money back.
Right. Yeah, and you know, someone like Alfred Hitchcock, when he made Psycho, the studio was hesitant to do it. So he actually worked out a deal where he paid for the entire cost of the movie in exchange for, and he didn't accept a salary either, in exchange for getting a portion of the profits. So that was something where the studio had nothing to lose. He had everything to lose because they put up the entire budget. But most movies, studios end up kind of taking a bath because they lose so much.
So you're just hoping for the one Titanic to keep you in business. That sounds wrong.
Yeah. Right.
Guess I could have probably picked a better feature film to throw out there than Titanic. Avatar. There we go. I guess they're rebuilding that ship. Have you seen that? From the original designs to putting people on.
Yeah, an eccentric millionaire is having Titanic rebuilt.
See, that's what you need to find to get hooked up with this movie thing.
Yeah. Right, if they've got money to burn.
Yeah, I mean, we could do something at least a little bit forward, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I didn't want to put a bad word on it, but that's just...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It seems a bit strange to me, but... Yeah. I guess it's their money, so they can do whatever they want with it.
Right.
I'm still just baffled by the whole thing. I guess that's probably not a good thing at this moment to be trying to debate how the merits of people spend their money, but... Anyway.
Yeah, don't let it bother you.
So have you ever thought about making it a real movie? I don't want to say real movie. That doesn't sound right. But an action movie or
a narrative.
Yeah.
Feature.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, those were the first movies I fell in love with growing up. So, as long as a good story is being told, whether that's a documentary or a narrative, those are the kind of movies I'm interested in making.
So have you been approached to do it, or is this something you thought about, or
it's,
what you think about?
Yeah, it's in the works. I like to write, so I think a good starting point is to come up with a good script that kind of would be able to get the support that it would need to get off the ground, so... Yeah, that's something I'm always working on.
Man of many talents. I mean, the creative side of things. I mean, let's talk about that for a while. Now this is just me being the bad editor that I am. You went and shot all this stuff, and you must think it's all good at the time, you know, or at least you want it to be good because you went out and did it.
Yeah.
So how do you take that, I don't know, 4-hour interview and cut it down to minutes? I mean, there's got to be a process to it. I mean, so what would be the process to do that?
Well, if you take any given interview that you've shot, the first thing to do is to just watch it, watch all the footage. And you start to notice that there's a common thread or that there's a common theme that starts to come forth that I never really notice it during the interview because I'm concerned with asking the next question and making sure I got the shot set up right. But when I watch the footage afterward, I notice that there's a little story being told, and it's my job to put the pieces in the right place to make sure that that person's story is told the best way. So with an interview, after you listen to it, after you watch it, I start to kind of cut it up and group it into ideas and thoughts. So if the person was talking about a major idea in the first part of the interview and then came back to it at the end, I try to kind of put that together and rearrange what they said to be in story form. And then it really starts to, the thing about editing is that it starts, the movie it kind of becomes its own creation and starts to tell itself. It's hard to explain, and you wouldn't really be able to understand it unless you kind of did it firsthand. But I've always found that movies, when you're editing them, they start to kind of tell you how to let them be told. So like a story starts to tell itself. You just have to listen and put it in the right sequence to let it tell itself. It becomes almost like a living thing that you just have to listen to.
Now, I've had plenty of authors on the show tell me that the characters start talking to them after they get to a certain point in the book. So, no, I at least follow the concept. It's not totally new, so.
Right.
But
yeah,
I think a character would probably
sure
be easier, but. I mean, once you get into get in character, it'd probably be easier, but I can see it coming together with a film, too.
Yeah, it's one of the most mysterious things about film to me is that it doesn't happen right away, because at the beginning it's nothing. It's like a big lump of clay with no form. But once you kind of push it in the right direction, it takes up its own momentum and just it's like a book that turns its own pages.
Yeah. So When you're editing and you got it all together, or you think you've got it all together, is there ever that aha moment or the lie-on moment where you know you're headed on the right track then? I mean, because there are times that I feel like I'm floundering around, you know. We all feel that way at times when we're doing a project. We're not sure we're doing the right thing, or we're not sure we're doing it the right way. So describe that when you realize that you've got the right story out of the interview, and then how much easier that makes it to record it or piece it together.
Yeah, I hardly ever feel like I've gotten it right. This has happened for the last few years. When I'm working on a certain project and I finally get it into a beginning, middle, and end form, and I think it's just about ready, the first thing I do is I show it to my wife, because she has the best taste in movies of anybody I've ever seen. Better than me. She sees things more clearly than I do. So when she watches it, and if she gives it the stamp of approval, then I know it's ready. But normally she'll have a couple of suggestions that always make it better. So I don't know about everybody else how they handle it, but I found that that works for me. She's the first. She's really, other than me, she's the first editor and the first audience member to take it in. And her response is how I tell how close I am to being on the right track.
And then you go back and fix it and go back to her then? I'm assuming it's the process, and then...
That's right, yeah. After I follow her suggestions, I take it back to her. And once she gives it the final stamp of approval, then I know it's ready.
I enjoy hearing the technical. I don't want to say technical because it's creative, but technical. But the process. There we go. I enjoy hearing about the nuts and bolts of life for somebody else because mm-hmm. I don't do movies or films or.
Right.
I got the face for radio going on. So anyway.
Yeah, I understand. Well, it's I mean, I know that's not the proper protocol to take it to your wife, but it's what works for me, so I plan on continuing to do it.
Well, you're going to have somebody, though, somebody you trust. I mean, before you take it to anybody else, I think you'd have to have a friend or a wife or
mm-hmm.
makes sense to me, at least. Maybe somebody probably, like we were talking about off air, somebody's probably rolling over in the grave, but that's okay. We like that.
Right. Yeah, I remember reading the acknowledgments of a book once, and the author said that his wife was his first editor, so that, you know, he had someone who was paid to be an editor to make sure the book was ready, but there was someone in between that step that he trusted more than anybody else, and that's what helped him make it the best he could make it.
Because if you're going to get bad news, you'd rather get it from somebody you love.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's do some... I don't want to say rapid fire because that's not necessarily the case. But I want to ask you some, like, what's your favorite movie, like, narrative movie?
I can't answer that because it's always changing. I have a group of movies that have impacted me the most, but it changes depending on. Well, I think the older I get, the more it changes, I think. Like, you know, when I was a kid, my favorite movie was E.T., and it's still a great movie, but I don't think I could put it in the number one spot anymore. But I have movies that have impacted me really deeply, like Grizzly Man, the documentary by Werner Herzog. It's the best documentary I've ever seen, and it's a huge inspiration to someone like me who makes documentary films to see that that's how high the bar has been set, and that's what a documentary is capable of. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
I recommend it very highly.
And go ahead and give the title out there one more time.
It's Grizzly Man.
Okay.
It came out in 2005. It's about an activist for grizzly bears named Timothy Treadwell, who spent the last 13 summers of his life going and living among the bears in Alaska. And eventually that's how he was killed. He was killed by one of the bears that he was trying to help.
Didn't they turn that into a narrative movie? Cause I think I remember seeing something about that somewhere.
No, it was pretty popular. I mean,
well, maybe
it was very popular. You probably have seen the poster or heard about it.
Yeah.
It was a pretty big hit.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking of then. So I did remember. So I did see a trailer or whatever for it. I didn't see the movie though.
Yeah.
So now here you go. This is going to be one of those questions that you're not going to be able to answer either, but I'm going to ask you anyways. Blank check if you know you get your narrative done, and I could cast you. Who would be your lead? I mean, it doesn't matter about the story. Just that one person you'd like to work with.
Well, I think the best actor we have working today is Daniel Day-Lewis. So to cross paths with him in any way would be incredible. I mean, it would be interesting to watch him read the phone book. There's just nothing he can't do.
Right. And for those who don't know, I haven't seen Lincoln yet. Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah.
And
it's lovely. It's I'm reading actually a book about Abraham Lincoln and his cabinet, and it's possible to see that movie and not picture Daniel Day-Lewis every time you think about Lincoln. Like, as I'm reading the book, I'm picturing Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln. He redefines your whole image of him.
Rivals?
I'm sorry, what?
Are you reading Team of Rivals?
Yeah, that's right.
That's a great book. It's okay, don't be sorry. I've read it. Well, that's one of the few books I've read, so don't be sorry. So.
No, yeah, it's a huge book. I've been reading it since before Christmas, and I'm still working on it. But the detail is incredible.
Yeah, I'm not a strong reader, but I found myself engulfed in that book for some reason, and I couldn't put it down. My wife's like, "Are you okay? Are you on new medication or something? Or is there something you need to tell me?" And I'm like, "No, it's just how she writes, and it's just that good." I'm like,
right.
I probably read it in 2 months, which, like you've said, it's just a heavy read, but
yeah.
And just the stories are fascinating. Of course, I find Lincoln fascinating, but she took it to a whole nother. Wait. You're from Kentucky, even. That makes this even a stronger connection there.
Yeah. Birthplace of Lincoln. It's hard to. What I find so inspiring as I read the book is that there's proof that people can be that good, because he was such an intelligent and compassionate person, and his life benefited the lives of so many others. It gives me hope about the capabilities of people, because we have historical proof that someone was that good a man.
Yeah, you have to take stuff away from that, and I can't imagine the stress that he must have been under between his family life and his country being at war with each other, not with, an overseas enemy. Having the enemy live 30 miles down the road. I mean, it just... Every time I think about stuff like that, it just baffles my mind to no end to think about how... And then be so graceful, for the lack of a much better word, under all of that. It's just remarkable. Because can you imagine what it'd do to some people today? It'd just be the end of things.
Yeah. No, I don't think I can imagine it. And that's why I know there's a popular theory that Lincoln had clinical depression, but I don't think that's true, because if that were true, it's just amazing that he was able to function and function well, which he did. Because, like you mentioned, his family life, losing his son, and his professional life of this country at war. If he had a clinical depression, he would be the type that would be secluded in his bed and not able to move. But he didn't. He got up every day and worked at finding a solution.
He not only worked every day, worked exorbitant hours,
tirelessly.
Too.
Right.
So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about The Vampire Hunter, then. Did you see that?
No, I missed that classic.
Oh, you've missed that one. That's an all right movie, too, but, I mean, obviously it's a little more entertainment-based. And there's also a Zombie Hunter, which is a low-end attempt at recreating the Vampire Hunter, I get the feeling, but they took some more liberties with history. I mean, it left a lot to be desired. So, but at the end of the day, that's all you can do is, have people doing that stuff. So, so I asked you about your favorite actor and your favorite film. Where would you go to film if I could send you somewhere?
Oh. Well, the most beautiful place I've ever been is Ireland. And any excuse to go back there, I would take. And it looks great on film, other movies that have done it, like Far and Away or The Quiet Man. It translates to film very beautiful. It really is that green. It really is that beautiful.
That is remarkable to think about. Because I've seen 100, all these pictures and all that stuff, but I can't imagine actually being that green and that wonderful.
I remember the time I was there, we were on a train going back to the bed and breakfast where we were staying, and I think we had ended up getting on the wrong train and we missed our stop and it kept going. And it went up. Us missing the stop was the best thing that ever happened because it kept on going and going and going and we were suddenly on this huge cliff overlooking the ocean. And there was all this beautiful scenery that we hadn't been able to see from where we were staying. And until you see it, you can't fathom that places like that still exist on the planet. But they do, and they're in places like Ireland.
Yeah, again, just the difference in the worlds and times and people, and just remarkable.
Yeah.
So we're winding down here. I want to give you a chance to make the hard sell. I know you're not good at that, but I figure I might as well give you an opportunity to try to do it here.
Right.
So crypto,
well,
it away, but sell me on it.
Well, CryptoTrip is, like you said, it's a documentary film about the effect that unexplained creature sightings have on eyewitnesses. And it's a surprising effect. It's a movie full of interesting conclusions that you wouldn't understand otherwise. So if you're into cryptozoology, into Bigfoot or the unexplained, anything like that, this is a movie that it kind of covers that interest itself. So all the information about it can be found on my website. It's cryptotrip.com. People can email me through the website. I answer all my emails. You can see updates about it on my Twitter account, which is Maloney's Movies. And copies of the DVD can be purchased at cryptotrip.com. And the DVD is actually a good deal because since there is not a distributor, technically, every DVD that's sold is an advanced copy. It's one that you won't be able to have once it does get picked up. So there's that going for it.
So pick it up now, and it'll be rare someday. So
that's right, because, yeah, I am handling all of it myself until it gets picked up. So that's something that'll be discontinued very soon.
Hopefully. We're knocking on wood for that for you.
Mm-hmm.
And before I forget, I'll be joining David Roundtree and Tracy Ray in a couple of minutes on their show. They just tried calling me, actually. So I guess I should mention that over at Live Paranormal, if anybody wants to go listen to me be on the other side of the mic, more of my self-promotion continues. I know nobody wants to hear me for another hour, but that's okay. I have to throw it out there since I'm doing it, so... But with that being said, Chris, I want to thank you for coming on. I wish you all of the best with your movie. I hope it grows and takes off, and I hope we get to have you back on when you're having your big release party. So,
thank you so much.
And with that being said, I'm going to click this outro, and have a good night, Chris.
Well, before we flip that on-air sign to the off position, a quick reminder. For all things about the report, previews, and reviews, go to italkparanormal.com. That's italkparanormal.com. Good night.
This is Thomas Trusco, author of the book.